When you look at prices, are things expensive or are they cheap? And are they expensive or cheap compared to what? Relative to what? Now, a lot of people think that real estate is way too expensive. It's at record highs, but expensive compared to what? Compared to US dollars or compared to gold or oil or rice or orange juice? And you need to understand there's a difference of priced in US dollars and purchasing power, the purchasing power of those units. When you understand it from this perspective, you get a whole new way to look at things. And so today I am joined by my good friend Jason Hartman. He's a real estate expert, a market analyst, and he is going to show us a new way to look at things and reframe things so that you can have more success. He's got the facts, the data. I took a ton of notes. This is something that really good, and it's going to give you a different perspective on where we're at in the market. We're at in the market cycle. We also dig into some tough topics, including where he thinks we're going in the future, how you should look at the market if you're a real estate investor or a homeowner, what factors like Wells Fargo shutting off lending does, what factors like BlackRock and Wall Street jumping in to buy all the residential real estate, what those do, and even guessing what the Fed might do with housing. So many good topics that we jumped in with Jason. It really gives you a whole new perspective that I think is powerful. So let's go ahead and just jump right in. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptors Show. And today I am joined again by my good friend Jason Hartman, who is a market analyst and a real estate expert. And he has come up with some amazing ways to look at the data in the markets and maybe even tell us where things are going. So Jason, thank you so much for coming back and joining us again.
Mark, it's great to be here. And yes, you know, for so many years or decades that I've been in the real estate business and real estate investing, I bought my first rental property when I was 20 years old. The magic question that is always, what's going to happen next, yeah. Right? How do we predict the market cycles? And you teach people that all the time on your show. And so I've developed an index, and it basically is a measuring stick comparing real estate prices to many other things in the world. And I believe they can tell us where we've been, where we are now, and where we're going in the future.
That's interesting on so many levels for me. I've been working on this big thesis on cycles, which I know I've shared with you. And the reason why it's history and cycles is for the same reason. It helps us know how we got here, what's going on, and where we're going in the future. So it's cool that you said that. Now, the other thing that also catches my interest is you're talking about looking at the price of real estate relative to other things, I think was what you're talking about. And that's something that I kind of pound the table on is to look at things in terms of purchasing power and not just US dollar terms.
Right.
So is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes, definitely to an extent, because, you know, if you think about it, Mark, people think housing is really expensive now because they measure it only in one thing. US dollars.
Right.
And nobody, you know, for example, take this example. Someone's saving for a house, right? Or, you know, and say they've been saving 10 years to buy a house and they're just a home buyer, not an investor, right? But they could be an investor either way. So they've been saving. Well, no one forced them to save their money denominated in US dollars, right? They could have easily converted as soon as they earned their dollars, they could have converted them to gold, rice, Bitcoin, oil, any one of a number of other things.
Yes.
And had they done that, they would feel the price of real estate is dramatically different than what they think of it as based in dollars.
Yes.
So it's really very interesting. And we're developing this whole new index around this whole concept of the question that I think is really life's most important question. I ask it all the time on my podcast and YouTube channel. And that question is, compared to what? That is life's most important question, in my opinion.
Hey guys, let me just interrupt this interview real quick just to plug the show sponsor, and that is BlockFi. Now, BlockFi is doing amazing things in the Bitcoin finance space. As a matter of fact, they've cracked some really big news by bringing on the ex-CFTC chair, Chris Giancarlo, and they are one of the most transparent, most heavily regulated companies inside the United States, which gives me a lot of trust into what their services are. Now, I've recently did a video talking about how to retire off of Bitcoin, and you can do that by leveraging debt and interest against Bitcoin, and BlockFi is the
the number one company in the United States or maybe in the world to go to and use. They are leading the charge. They're paying interest on your Bitcoin if you park it with them, or you can borrow against it. Now, as I broke down in that video, you can borrow against your Bitcoin. And when you take debt against it, it's not taxable. It's not a taxable event. You can use that debt for anything that you want, including to live off of, to leverage up and buy more, or roll it into another asset. You can do something like I've done recently, like sell some real estate, put that money into Bitcoin. Now, as that Bitcoin price has risen, I'm able to borrow against it and go back and buy the same real estate or something similar. And I still own the Bitcoin and I also own the new asset as well. Lots of ways you can do this. And BlockFi is the company that I recommend. Down in the description, I have a link that you can click on. If you choose to use that link, you can earn up to $250 in Bitcoin just for using that link. So check out BlockFi now. Such a good way to look at that. A lot of people don't realize that, but right, we're always trading one thing for another. So I'm trading my dollars for the real estate or trading my dollars for that meal. But to your point, it could have been trading rice or oil for that house or that meal. I often throw these numbers out and I don't have the numbers. I just say hypothetically, but you know, let's say, you know, 1960, the median home price was $50,000. Today, it's now up to like $350,000. But back then, it was so many ounces of gold or so many barrels of oil. And today, it's about the same amount of ounces of gold and same amounts of barrels of oil. But of course, I'm just kind of spitballing that. But I think you actually have some data that shows that.
We do. We have a whole bunch of data on not just oil and gold, but a whole bunch of other things. So let's dive into it.
Yeah, let's dive into it because I think, again, this is something I pound the table on the video that went live yesterday. Again, I tell people, start thinking about things in terms of purchasing power, not dollars. And just while you get ready, I know you're going to show us some slides. I'm excited to see them. But to set the stage a little bit, you know, I've done quite a bit of a discussion on hyperinflation that's happened in other countries. And one thing that really just shocked me, I did this video on how a currency dies. And I read this book called When Money Dies, and it talks about hyperinflation in Germany after the war. And what was interesting is as the prices were going higher in their currency, everyone thought they were getting rich. My house has never been worth this much money. Yeah. My gold has never been worth this much money. I better sell my whatever asset now while it's still high before it drops back down.
Yeah.
And so they did. And so they sold all their assets for currency, which then ended up being worthless. And they ended up burning it in the fireplace instead of wood because it was actually worth less than wood.
I agree.
And so anyway, it's super important to understand purchasing power. So let's go ahead and jump in and show me what you got.
Yeah. And you know, Mark, to your point, if you go to Wikipedia and you type in Weimar Republic, Weimar Germany, right?
Yeah.
You'll see that picture, which I'm sure you've seen, of a woman basically loading the currency, okay, the Deutschmarks, into a furnace to extract heat from them because it was cheaper than trading the currency units for wood.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just amazing. Yeah. And every fiat currency ever throughout history has gone to its intrinsic value, the paper it's printed on. So,
The average life expectancy of a fiat currency is only 35 years, and we're at 50 now. So we're living on borrowed time, to say the least.
Well, this is a seminal moment in history because it is the 50-year anniversary of Nixon detaching the dollar from the gold standard. It's actually next month.
Yeah.
So, truly, truly amazing. So, I'll share my screen and let's dive into this. I'm glad we're on the same page with that. And so, you know, it's really all about the measuring stick. And like we were saying, people are using the dollar as the measuring stick. And that is a mistake. You know, no one cares about dollars. They only care what dollars can buy us, right?
Yeah.
You know, before I dive into this too deeply, I just want to reiterate something I've talked on your show about before. There are really three types of real estate markets: linear, cyclical, and hybrid markets.
Yeah.
They act differently. In this example today, just for the interest of time, we only are comparing to median home price. But just understand that if you were to drill down, things change, whether you're in Los Angeles or Memphis, right? Very different in the markets we buy properties in. So just want you to know that. And the question is, compared to what? It happens with trading in the economy. It also happens in every other part of our life. You know, we are comparison beings by nature. We look at our neighbors neighbor's house. We look at our neighbor's yard and say, hey, are they doing better than I am? We look at their car. You know, when we were single, we look in the marketplace for a mate and we compare. The only reason you know, for example, that your wife, the woman you married, is more beautiful than another was by comparison, right? That's the only way we know anything is by comparison. So life's most important question is compared to what? To drill down on that question, for this example, as we're talking today, is let's talk about our friend George's question is it cheap or is it expensive?
Right.
And so as we do that and we consider whether or not we're in a bubble, the index can give us the answer. The HCI, the Hartman Comparison Index, can give us the answer. And it can also maybe, we'll leave that up to the people listening and watching, will it tell us when the bubble will pop, right? And so—
well, that's a question I want to know the answer to.
Right. Well, we're going to explore that one for sure. And we need to understand that when we're thinking about this, that a house or an apartment complex as investors, right, it's made up of commodities. And that's why I call this packaged commodities investing. So we're going to look at ingredients, steel, lumber, copper wire, petroleum products, et cetera. We just have to understand that a house is just a set of commodities that are assembled and packaged. So of course, I've got that free book for all of your listeners at pandemicinvesting.com, where I've taken a lot of these principles and applied them to the times we're living in. And that's at pandemicinvesting.com. We talked before on your show about inflation-induced debt destruction, and it totally shows when you look at the index, because when you price things in real dollars and you compare, say, the consumer price index with the Case-Shiller housing index, you see that mostly it's parallel, but at times it gets really out of sync. And that's just what happens. And we've had our money printer in chief, Jerome Powell, printing money like crazy. Before we dive into the index and the comparisons, we have to talk about a couple other indexes real quickly. One is the HPI, the House Price Index. I think it's very flawed and does not do as good a job as the index we'll talk about. And then, of course, the Case-Shiller Index, also very flawed, because the 20 markets the Case-Shiller Index profiles could really lead someone to make big, big mistakes. Why do I say that? Because 15 of those 20 markets, two-thirds of them, Mark, are cyclical markets. And it just wouldn't be prudent for a real estate investor to make decisions based on only those cyclical markets, or at least two-thirds cyclical.
The big problem that I have with those home price indexes and the Shiller index, and I've done videos on this as well, is that they take into account the price of the home.
Right.
But nobody pays the price of the home.
Right.
So while we're back up to 2008 levels or maybe slightly above, interest rates are half. And so if you look at the month payment, I think it's, you know, over 90% of first-time buyers are financing the home, 90% financing. So it's always about the monthly payment. And so if you look at the payment amount, because interest rates have dropped in half since 2008, it gives you a different picture. Do you take that into consideration?
Absolutely. That's the second part of the index is payment. The first price part is price. And I couldn't agree with you more. Nobody buys a house based on the price. They only buy it based on the payment.
Right.
So you're absolutely right about that. This index, the Housing Affordability Index, is actually my favorite outside of the new HCI index that we launched.
Yeah.
Because it does consider payment. It looks at median house payment versus median income in a given area. Its major flaw, though, is it doesn't account for foreign money or retirees that buy properties for cash. Okay, so there are some flaws in that as well, and I think the comparison index really, really gives us the answer. So let's look at gold. Gold, although I'm not a gold bug, and I don't think you are either, although I'm not sure.
I've been a gold bug for a dozen years. Now I consider myself a sound money advocate.
Yes, I love it. And I'm guessing Bitcoin is your sound money. So we're going to get to that one next. But let's look at gold. I mean, look, gold to be fair to it, has been considered money for 5,000 years. Humanity has considered gold to be money.
Right.
And so it would be completely unfair to not consider gold. So if you go back to 1970, 1 year before we went off the gold standard, if you wanted to buy the median price house for $22,000, I'm rounding off here, obviously, mm-hmm. and you had gold at $35, it would cost 646 ounces of gold to buy the median price house. Fast forward to the year 2000, a generation ago. Back then, 21 years ago, to buy the median price house for $173,000 with gold at $283 an ounce, it would take you 610 ounces of gold to buy the median price house. But guess what, Mark? Today, if you want to buy the median price house, it will only cost you 194 ounces of gold. Mm. So your briefcase full of gold has gotten a lot lighter.
Yeah.
Okay. So measured in gold or priced in gold, is housing cheap or expensive?
Cheap. It's gotten much cheaper. It's gone from 650 to 200.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it's a third of the price.
646. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And even compared to a generation ago or 51 years ago, it's truly amazing that if you were saving your money in gold, your house has gotten a lot cheaper. Okay. So let's look at Bitcoin, your favorite. Right. And hey, I'm a fan too. I hope Bitcoin succeeds wildly. I would love it. It doesn't go back far enough with Bitcoin,
right.
But in 2010 is, you know, that's where we start. To buy the median price house at $224,000, take you 773,000 Bitcoin. A year ago, last year, to buy the median price house at $359,000, 12 Bitcoin. Mm. And today, even though Bitcoin isn't that much higher because it's had some losses lately, the house price at $347,500, you're looking at 34,000 Bitcoin. Okay.
$34,000
Bitcoin.
Right.
Okay, $35,000 Bitcoin. And it takes 10 Bitcoin. Okay. Right. So priced in Bitcoin, is housing cheap or expensive, right?
Oh, it's gotten from 773,000 to 10. So yeah.
A lot cheaper. Okay. The most important commodity on earth, I would argue, is oil.
Right.
There is no commodity on earth that is more important than oil. Forget about what all the tree huggers say. Doesn't matter. The fact is, at the end of the day, the world is still running on oil. Okay.
Yep.
In 1970, oil was only $3 a barrel.
Wow.
$3 a barrel. Today it's 75, right?
Yeah.
So the median house price, $23,000, give or take. 6,700 barrels of oil to trade that for a house. Okay. I'll jump to the year 2000. 6,300 or rounded off 6,400 barrels of oil to buy the median house. Today, only 4,600 barrels of oil will buy you the median house. So priced in oil, is housing cheap or expensive?
Well, it's definitely gotten cheaper, about a third cheaper than it was in 1970.
Yeah. What's
interesting is I like to ask people this question, which is, do you think, given all the advancements in technology, that it's actually more work to bring oil to the marketplace? right? Like to transport it, package it. Like, do you actually think it's more expensive or is it less expensive? Right.
Yeah.
It's gotten easier. It has gotten easier and should have gotten cheaper, but it's gone the other way.
And not only that, you know, what you mentioned is certainly true. The technology of the actual, you know, running of the plant, like we'll call it the heavy equipment, that's better and cheaper, right? But also just the technology of the software that controls the inventory supply and manages that and manages the shipping and supply chain, that's gotten so much better and so much more efficient, just radically efficient, that it is cheaper. So that what that really shows is that the dollar is just losing value dramatically,
right.
Okay? So orange juice, now this one's different, okay? This one is different. in orange juice, priced in orange juice, houses have become a lot more expensive. So what I recommend to all of our listeners is, you know, just to go look at the chart, 1970, it took you 51,000 pounds of orange juice to buy a house. 2000, because I'm just skipping to, you know, make in the interest of time, 210,000 pounds of orange juice to buy a house. Today, 280,000 pounds to buy a house, right? So priced in orange juice, houses have become expensive. So my recommendation is that everybody dilute their orange juice with champagne or vodka.
Okay. Well, also what it does is it illustrates that what you use as your store of value and your unit of account matters.
It does matter. Yeah, absolutely matters. Absolutely matters. So I'll do rice and then we'll move on to the payment side of the equation just to, in the interest of time. So the reason I pick rice as a very important thing is, you know, rice is the food stock for two thirds of the world. Two thirds of humanity survives on rice. Yeah, they eat other things a little bit too, but rice is their staple. Okay. Right. It's like the base food. And you did a great video, by the way, recently on the Great Reset of Food. Really want to recommend that to people.
Thank you.
So 1970, if you wanted to buy the median price house, it would take you 42,000 pounds of, or 43,000 pounds of rice, okay? In 2000, it would be 31,000. Today, it's only 27,000. So priced in rice, housing is cheaper, okay?
Would you say it is today, 27,000?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. 27,000, yeah.
Nice.
You know what? Let's not move on too quickly. I want to do S&P, okay? This is important because the S&P, the Standard & Poor's, the S&P 500 index accounts for 72% of all consumer spending in the country. It's a pretty good measure for how the economy is doing. You know, the S&P 500 is a large part of the overall economy. So in 1970, it would cost you 243 shares of the S&P index at $93 to buy the median price house.
How many was that?
243 shares to buy a house in 1970.
Yeah.
In 2000, it would cost you 119 shares of the S&P to buy the median price house. But today, it only costs you 80 shares of the S&P to buy the median price house. So priced in the S&P, housing is a lot cheaper than it was.
Yeah, way cheaper. Yeah. Okay?
In median income, not so cheap.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, how many years do you need to work to buy a house with cash, right? In 1970, you needed to work 2.6 years. In 2000, 4.1 years. Today, you have to work 4.8 years if you are in the median income to buy a house. Now, we're going to get to the payment part in a moment.
What did you say it was in 2000?
In 2000, 4.1 years. Yeah.
4.1. 2.6, 4.1, 4.8.
Yeah, going from 1970 to 2000.
So what that tells you, the way that I look at that is this is the reason why the money is losing value is because they keep printing so much of it. Right. And in this illustration right here, took 2.5 years of your life. That's your life. The most scarce asset in history is your time. All other assets we can get more of if we lose it, but you can't get back your time. Right. So it took 2.5 years of your life that you can't get back to buy that house. Today, it takes almost five.
Yeah.
So double. And so what they're doing by the money printer is actually stealing your life. They're stealing your life.
Absolutely. You know, listen to what Mark just said there, folks. The only thing any of us really have is our time. That's it. And what Mark said is right on. You just nailed it. Because they are literally, by debasing the currency, they are also stealing the years of your life away.
Yeah.
So that's why you listen to this show, because you want to learn how to turn that the other way. You want to learn how to not be affected, or maybe even to thrive by aligning your interests with what I call the two most powerful entities that have ever existed in human history: governments and central banks. And that's what we're here to help you do. Okay. So yeah, it's a lot. Now Forbes, interestingly, Forbes magazine publishes in their own economic index, their own version, Mark, of the CPI, the consumer price index.
Okay.
But they call it the cost of living very well. So this is like the CPI for rich people. Okay. And what's interesting about it is that we also took in the Hartman Comparison Index in the HCI, we compared the cost of living very well index to house prices. And here's what we found. In 1970, it would take 581 shares of this index to buy the median price house. Today, it only takes 506 shares. So for wealthy people, houses have become cheaper. Not two-thirds cheaper, like some of the people that held the gold or a Bitcoin, radically cheaper, or whatever, oil, et cetera, but still cheaper, okay,
no.
In the cost of living very well index. Now, copper, you're going to find some differences there. Copper is a super important commodity. They call it Dr. Copper for a reason.
Yeah.
1970, 448,000 pounds of copper to buy the house, 2000, 204,000 pounds in 2000. Wow. Today, only 81,000 pounds. So from 2000 to today, basically a generation, 21 years, right? Housing is less than half the price in copper than it was then. Okay. So let's.
Everything but OJ.
Yeah. Yeah. Orange juice. Definitely. Yeah. Not so good. Okay. So now let's talk about the payment. Okay. We compare it to a whole bunch of other things. Find out more at my website, jasonhartman.com, or on my YouTube channel or podcast, The Creating Wealth Show. But payment, you mentioned that earlier, and I want to get to payment because the index considers not only the price of the house, but also the typical mortgage payment. And with interest rates, like you said, Mark, being half of what they were, it's really staggering what happens to the payment. So let's look at the mortgage payment based in the median home price adjusted for inflation and then priced in Bitcoin. Okay, it's staggering what's happened. So the median mortgage payment, 1970 was $142. By 2000, it was $984. Today, compared to 2000, it's only $1,170. But when you adjust it for inflation, back in 1970, it was $142. Today, it's only $169. It's not that much more expensive, adjusted for the official rate of inflation, which is fake, which is manipulated. So basically, if you put in the real rate of inflation, the house payment has become quite a bit cheaper than it was in 1970. Based in Bitcoin, it's almost free to have a house payment, okay?
Wow.
Based in gold, though, to make your payment in gold in 1970, it took 4.1 ounces. In 2000, it took 3.5 ounces of gold. Today, it only takes 0.7 ounces of gold to pay your mortgage. In barrels of oil, 1970, it took 42 barrels of oil to pay the house payment. In 2000, 36 barrels. And today, only 16 barrels a month to live in that house for your mortgage payment. Okay. Orange juice, it's gotten a little more expensive. It's not the most expensive it was. 944 pounds of orange juice per month today. 319 in 1970. But in 2000, 1,200 barrels, or not barrels, pounds. So it's a little cheaper than it was in 2000.
Yeah.
Whatever it's worth. Yeah.
That's cheaper.
How about shares of the S&P? Okay. 1970, if you want to pay your house payment, you could cash in 1.5 shares of the S&P, convert it to dollars, pay your mortgage. In 2000, if you did that, it would only take 0.7, less than half, to pay your mortgage payment. Today, it only takes 0.3. So priced in the S&P, your mortgage payment is dramatically cheaper in a bunch of things, okay? How about hours worked at the average wage? In 1970, you talk, Mark, about stealing your time. Mm-hmm. In 1970, 41 hours at the average wage to pay your mortgage. In 2000, it took 69 hours. Today, it only takes 46 hours. So, you know, cheaper than it was 21 years ago, a little more expensive than it was 51 years ago. Tuition, we do it indexed in tuition, college tuition, a whole bunch of other things. But the bottom line is housing overall is cheaper in almost anything you compare it to today, both on a price of the house basis, but even more so on a monthly payment basis.
Yeah.
It is getting cheaper. And that's why I say we've got a few good years ahead of us probably in the housing market. Now, I do want to make the disclaimer that the index is a comparison index. It's called the Hartman Comparison Index. It compares things. It doesn't consider other things like foreclosure moratoriums, inventory levels, all of that stuff. But I will say a lot of data is in the price of things. The price of anything offers a ton of data of what the market
price is data. Price is communication. So price is the signal that communicates everything. And so at its core, that's what it is. Yeah. I'm curious though, because as George says, you know, is it expensive or is it cheap? But that doesn't tell everything, right? So just because homes maybe aren't as expensive on a monthly basis or comparatively as they were in the past doesn't necessarily mean that they won't crash again. And just because they're lower doesn't mean they can keep going up either, right?
Right. So right now we're doing the index on a quarterly basis. We're putting in new numbers every quarter, okay? And we want to get it to a monthly basis, but hey, this is a new thing and we're staffing up, okay, for the index.
Okay.
And so, you know, just keep following the index. And when the index says housing is expensive compared to all these other things, then you know that is a dangerous point. And we will get there, especially if these dysfunctionally low interest rates continue.
Yeah.
We will get to that point. So we're just not there yet.
Hey, sorry to interrupt this video just one more time. I'm not running Google ads, so it's actually way less interruption than I normally would have on a video. And that's because it's sponsored by BlockFi. They are opening up the world of Bitcoin and financial products, offering to pay you interest on your Bitcoin, better than owning a rental property that you have to manage and control and have the risks. You can just earn interest on it, or you can leverage against it. Now, I plan to hold my Bitcoin forever and literally never sell my Bitcoin. So how do you do that? Well, if I need money, I don't want to sell that Bitcoin. I'm going to pay tax on it. All right. I'm going to end up with less and I don't have the Bitcoin anymore. So a better way to do it is to borrow against the Bitcoin. So I've put all my money into Bitcoin. If I want to buy a car or I want to buy a house, I can borrow against it at very, very low competitive rates, get my house, get my car, whatever that may be, and get to keep the Bitcoin. Now, I've done a whole video on this. You can find it. I'll link it down in the description below, how to retire off of Bitcoin without paying taxes. And you can do that with BlockFi services. I'll link to the video down below. I'm also going to put a link to BlockFi. If you choose to click on that link to check them out, you can earn up to $250 in free Bitcoin just for using that link. And that's it. Let's go ahead and get back to the interview. Yeah. So it looks at the price of things. And so I like that because from its most basic, most people are like, oh, real estate's way too expensive. It's got to crash any moment. So it gives you a different perspective on the price. Like I said, I keep pounding the table on this purchasing power. It brings you back to that, which so it's perfect for that. I was taking notes and writing down a bunch of those amounts because I'm going to use some of that data. But like I said, just because price is cheap doesn't mean it's going to keep going up. And just because it's expensive doesn't mean it's going to crack either. We have the wild card, as I call it. These are the banksters. And we don't know what the banksters are going to do. So for example, the Fed and the government has done everything in their power to prop the markets up. You know, over the last year, they've spent trillions of dollars to do that. And a lot of it has been done in the mortgage industry specifically, you know, buying mortgage-backed securities and whatnot. And then even with the, you know, rent moratoriums and eviction moratorium, they were helping for payments. So it seems like that's this big wild card and we don't know what's in their head. Will they continue? Will they not? So how do you factor that in?
I'm really glad you mentioned that. What we are adding to the Hartman Comparison Index is a mortgage sensitivity component, a mortgage interest rate sensitivity component, because it's a good question. What would happen if the Fed and the government and the banksters, you know, this collusion between these entities, which is so secretive and just ridiculous, frankly, you know, what would happen if they tighten the money supply and interest rates go up? Well, the Fed doesn't directly control mortgage rates, but they certainly influence them in a huge way. And so, you know, if rates went up by, say, 1%, which is really a 33% increase, depending on the exact rate, it's very approximate there. You know, then it would certainly make housing much less affordable. So you're absolutely right. But when that happens, the likelihood is all of the other compared to what items in the HCI will also react to that, right? Certainly the S&P will, gold prices will, copper prices, everything reacts, right? But here's the problem, and here's why it's so hard to make predictions, right? And here's why so many people who claim to be good at making predictions fall on their sword at some point in time, right? Is because these things don't act in lockstep. There's a lag time between these reactions of different items in the economy. And so, you know, what you can be pretty safe with, I think, is looking at big macro trends. Sure. And that's what I like looking at. And I think it's what you like looking at too. If you're trying to make predictions and be a day trader, you're probably gonna get in trouble. Okay.
So, I'm curious, well, I want to see, I want to ask you, I want to nail you down as to what you see in the near and long-term future.
Oh, sure.
But before we jump into that, for everybody watching, make sure you stay to that because I'm going to ask Jason. This is a conversation as I was walking down the beach trail last night with my wife here in Southern California. I mean, homes have doubled. I mean, they're up 100% in a year and a half. I mean, it's insanity. And we were having this conversation tonight, so I want to nail you down and ask you what you think about that. But before we do, I'd like to ask you about two other triggers that I'm looking at. So one is there's been big news. I did a video on this about BlackRock and the hedge funds and Wall Street buying up single family homes. Now, they are basically taking near free money from the money printer, getting it from their buddies at the Fed. They're getting it for almost free, and they're buying up entire tracts of single family homes, the bread and butter, as us real estate investors would call that. And they're overpaying by a large amount of money because they're looking at different numbers than we are. They can get free money and make 2 or 3%. Heck, they're fine with that. So they'll overpay. And that's a big trend, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. How does that piece fit into the narrative, I guess?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's bullish for real estate prices and bullish for real estate rents because these institutions have more data than we do, and they obviously are still doing what they do, right? And because of that, I think it's bullish. So
Meaning in the investment world, we'd call that the smart money and we're the dumb money. So then meaning if the smart money is putting their money there, then maybe we think about it as well.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a good indicator. Yeah, I do.
Even though they're potentially overpaying because their number metrics are way different than ours.
Fair enough. That's a very good point. Yeah, I think it's okay. And here's the thing, you know, a lot of people, I got asked a question similar to yours just recently on another podcast I was doing. And, you know, at the end of the day, we have to remember that the number of houses and the amount of housing demand isn't changing that much, right? There's still a shortage of about 5.5 million houses, according to NAR, National Association of Realtors, that has a very big statistical, you know, research department. And so we still have that same shortage. It doesn't matter if they're rental homes or for sale homes. The fact is we have people that need a place to live, right? That's what happens at the end of the day. Now, I do want to mention, though, and this is a far out thing, so no one needs to worry about it today, But you know, in 30 to 40 years, this dynamic looks like it will change quite dramatically because the birth rate is declining. And the one thing that has to happen for all of this real estate investing to work is you have to have demand. You have to have people. You have to have population growth, or at least stable population. And so that's super important. And you have to not have a disruptive construction technology that supplies a lot more housing to the market. And right. So, you know, I've done deep, deep research on my shows about 3D printed homes, about manufactured homes, and none of these things, forget about the hype you're hearing, it's BS. It's simply not true. I've hired a consultant to look at it and all sorts of stuff. And none of these things are disrupting housing construction anytime soon. It's a low-tech process, and it requires materials. Even if they're 3D printed, it's still concrete, right? It's still materials. Yeah. And there are land use restrictions and all kinds of problems with building. So I'm not worried about too much supply anytime soon, and I'm not worried about declining demand anytime soon.
Okay. On the next question I had was, our good friend George Gammon has been talking quite a bit about what's going on in the repo market and now the reverse repo market.
Yep.
And without getting deep into that, basically the banks were running out of money back in 2019. And so the Fed was giving them liquidity. Now it's reverse repo. So the banks are putting money back to the Fed. This seems to be a signal of a big problem. The banks have all this money. They don't want to lend it out. And now they're putting it back to the Fed. Then on top of that, I want to dive super deep into that. But yesterday, big news came across the news world of Wells Fargo wanting to shut down equity lines of credit. What do you think about that? Is that like a warning sign? Because after the 2008 crash, everybody's credit lines got pulled. Right. Yeah, the liquidity dried up. It was too risky for them to lend money. And now it's almost as if they're preemptively doing that. What are you thinking about that?
Well, I think that's a bearish sign. A credit contraction will definitely cause demand to level off as the Fed tapers, which some argue they're about to do, and some argue that it's going to be a couple years. I don't know. Nobody really knows for sure, except Jerome Powell.
Even that, doesn't know, probably.
Real estate is a credit-based asset class.
Right.
And if you constrict the supply of credit, you're going to constrict the affordability. But remember something. That doesn't reduce the population, and it doesn't increase the supply. So if people can't buy houses, they'll rent them. They'll be forced to rent them, right? There's only two choices, three.
Right.
Buy rent or be homeless, right?
Right.
That
option's great too.
Right.
Between drying up a little bit of the credit, like with Wells Fargo, that's maybe a canary in the coal mine, maybe. And then we've seen interest rates start ticking back up again from their lows as well. So the interest rates tick up, and the lack of credit both do the same thing, which is make it more expensive to buy the home. The monthly payment goes up.
Right.
And if the monthly payment goes up, does that bring the price of the home back down?
Well, here's what really happens. Yes, it does put downward pressure on prices, but what people really, it's just weird to me, Mark. And I've, over the last 20 years of having discussions about this exact thing, people will say, well, if incomes are stagnant and prices are rising, how are tenants going to be able to afford to rent my house from me? Or, if the economy's bad, unemployment's high, whatever, right? Whatever happens. The point is, what gives in the equation mostly is the standard of living. People are forced to move down or not move up in the first place, right?
Right.
So, if you talk to one of your tenants today, and then you talk to that same tenant 5 years from now, if these things happen, right, they'll say things like, well, we used to live in a 2,500 square foot house in a better neighborhood, and now we live in a 1,200 square foot house in an inferior neighborhood with worse schools. What gives is the standard of living.
Right.
But economists don't follow this very well.
Yeah.
They follow, the rate of inflation through the highly manipulated bogus CPI, the consumer price index, sure. But they don't follow people right? And they don't say this exact couple that had this life 5 years ago has this life today.
Right.
Right. They don't do that. I mean, not very much, at least, not in any real.
And that's such an important point that you hit on, because again, as real estate investors, we talked, as I mentioned, about the bread and butter, right? So that's a entry level 3-bedroom, right, 2-bath home. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we've always liked those, at least speaking for myself, is because, to your point, it's the entry level that people come to. And if people fall down, they're going to fall down to that level. And also people coming up are to that level.
Yeah.
And so
that's why the entry level is great, because you catch them either way.
You catch some people
moving down the economic ladder and others moving up it. Yeah.
But that's exactly where BlackRock and the Wall Street hedge funds are targeting, is entry level 3-bedroom, 2-bath as well.
Sure. But it's also where all of our investors target as well, and where you target. So, you know, we all do that. Yeah.
But I guess just reinforcing the point of maybe it's a bullish signal, right? They know what they're doing, kind of a thing.
Right. Yep.
Because I think, you know, one thing, and again, so much of this is unknown because of these banksters, you know, we don't know what's in their head, but I tend to think that they didn't just create $8 trillion in the last 14 months to stop now.
Yeah. Yeah, right. No.
Like, they're not going to just do that just to stop now. Why would they not keep it going?
You're absolutely right. Look at the, you know, it's amazing to me, Mark, and I'm sure you have the same thought I do, right? Every time the G7 meets, or the G20 meets, you know, the big industrialized countries, right? Every time there's a meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where the Fed has their annual meeting, or they go to Davos, Switzerland, and, you know, the creepy World Economic Forum, right? Basically, their only answer, they can call it whatever they want. They've got all these complicated names, but their only answer to any of these problems is create more currency units. Yes.
Well,
print money.
That's all they can do.
That's it. That's all they got. Okay. Yeah. They've got these little things and dials they turn and all, but that's basically, at the end of the day, it's all just money printing. Yeah. Okay. And they're not going to stop, because no politician or Fed chair or central bank chair of any other central bank, the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, whatever, they don't want to make people take the tough medicine during their tenure. The only guy that ever did that was the late Paul Volcker, who was Fed chair in the early 80s. Yeah. He did do that. He tightened the money supply. Interest rates went up through the roof. The economy just stalled like a car crashing into a wall. And it was tough, but it broke the back of inflation. And I say there is no way that's happening in today's world. People are just too wimpy. They're not willing to do it. It's never going to happen.
So then looking into the future, so then it's like, if the Fed stops, which, as we discussed, is probably unlikely, but if the Fed were to stop with their intervention, buying mortgage-backed securities, propping up banks, et cetera, then potentially we could see the real estate market turn around and crash from here. However, if definitely. They continue down the path they've been going down, to your point, when the whole world looks like a hammer or a nail, when all you have is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail.
Yep.
If they go till they blow, which is kind of what I'm thinking, we could potentially see things go way higher and further than we might imagine.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So if I was thinking about buying a piece of real estate in the United States, I would first divide it into two buckets, as an investor or as a homeowner. Mm-hmm. But let's say as an investor, I think the only strategy that really makes sense is to try and buy it for cash flow. Unfortunately, the amount of cash flow that you can get today has gotten greatly reduced, partly because of BlackRock and Wall Street jumping in. They're working on razor thin margins. But let's look at it from a homeowner perspective. As I said, this is the conversation I was having last night. I mean, I'm not kidding, man. Here in Southern California, prices are up like 100% in like a year and a half or 2 years. It's insane. $1.8 million homes are now going for $3.5 million, like just like that. So is it the top? I mean, would you buy at double the price, or would you wait a couple years and wait for those prices to come back down? Or are they going to go till they blow? How do you think through something like that? And I know different markets are different, cyclical, linear, et cetera, but how would somebody think through that when they're thinking about buying a house for themselves as a family, but prices seem to be sky high? Do you wait or do you buy, and how do you evaluate that?
Yeah. I think in the cyclical markets, meaning the West Coast of the United States, the expensive Northeastern markets, South Florida, where I live, right? If you're in an expensive market, I think there's a much greater risk to possibly things going the other way. But if you're buying in a cheap market where the housing prices are relatively low, it's a linear market. You know, if you go to jasonhartman.com and click on the properties page on my website, you'll see properties that are in these good, solid linear markets. The insurance mark that people have against downturns, think about this. When you have insurance, you don't worry as much. You don't care as much because you're insured. And the insurance people have is the linear markets offer good cash flow. And cash flow is very reliable. Appreciation is not very reliable. It's very speculative. Mm-hmm. So if you buy a property, you know, one of my 10 commandments of successful investing is thou shalt not gamble. It's commandment number 5.
Yeah.
And that means that the property must make sense the day you buy it or you don't buy it.
Yeah, you make your money when you buy, not when you sell.
Yeah, and I don't mean you're buying like under market and finding that deal that nobody can really find in real life, right? I mean the property has good cash flow characteristics. And if you do that, that's your insurance policy. If the value goes down, who cares?
Right.
I mean, on my website, you'll see properties that have projected returns of 20-25% annually, all in, right? That's not cash on cash. It's all the ways you earn returns on a property. And there are many ways. It's a multidimensional asset class. Great video on my website, 32 minutes long, that can teach you how to analyze a real estate deal. It's been watched zillions of times, and it really teaches you how to analyze a deal so you won't get hurt on a deal.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And that's what people have to do. You know, if you're buying in a cyclical market, you are speculating. So be careful.
But as an investor, definitely be careful, because if your property is worth half as much, now you know, in California, specifically, but back to California, I mean, we saw the worst real estate crash in history was like 89 to 92, and it dropped about 30% during those 4 years. But then in 2008, it dropped 60% in 12 months. So we got a different taste of what might be possible. And I know it happened in Florida as well. But I would say, so if you're an investor and the property drops 50%, like you're screwed. I mean, you're stuck.
Have good cash flow, because you're not forced to sell.
Not if you have good cash flow. Correct. Which is why I said, I think for investing in real estate, cash flow is the only option today, the strategy. But if I was buying a home, I think about it like, is this a place that I want to live forever? And if I can lock in these historically low rates and I'm happy with the payment, and if the value of the property dropped in half, but I still get to live there and I still have the good payment, then why not? Right. And so mm-hmm. I kind of think about that. But if I was going to buy for 2 or 3 years and then hopefully move up, well, maybe that's not the best decision. What do you think?
The way people lose money on real estate most of the time is they are forced to sell a property at an undesirable time.
Yep. That happened to me.
Okay. So yeah, and what forces them to? Property that never made sense, that doesn't have cash flow, yep. that won't cover its cost and exactly. hopefully generate positive cash flow, or a divorce.
Yeah.
Those two things. Yeah. Okay. And if you're not forced into that, you're probably going to be okay, because you just can wait.
Yeah.
And earn that return every single year.
Yeah. Now, last question I want to ask before we start wrapping this up is, you've just given us this, the index, the Jason Hartman index, which I think is really
the
cool.
Hartman Comparison Index.
I'm sorry, the HCI, Hartman Comparison HCI. Index.
Yeah.
So, you know, we looked at real estate's cheap compared to gold, Bitcoin, barrels of oil, pounds of rice, not OJ, but S&P, et cetera. Now, many people think that real estate is the best investment and it's the way to build wealth. But per the HCI, it actually looks like it hasn't been that best investment. It actually looks like I should have probably just put my money into the S&P or, you know, oil, gold, Bitcoin, et cetera.
That's an interesting question. But what I didn't say is that those other things don't produce income and they don't produce tax benefits. So the income property, and they don't give you inflation-induced debt destruction. So the income property is the best investment. But yes, you are right. That's very good of you to point that out, that just on the straight price, right? Buying the house in gold versus the house, right? It's gotten cheaper. Good point.
But also, in addition to the things that you said, so the tax benefits cannot be understated. I mean, that's a big deal.
They're huge.
Because like you said, some of those properties are 25% all in. Cash on cash, they could be 3 or 4%, but all in, they could be 25.
And the gold doesn't give you any yield every year.
Right.
And so it's taxed at the collector rate when you sell it.
Right.
Whereas the income property, you can exchange no tax. Yeah.
Yeah, we need cash flow to live on.
Right.
And so that's why it's super important. The other thing, though, that you didn't call out, but is the leverage. And so I can put 10% down and control the whole price of the house. Right. Yep. I can't put 10% down on gold, Bitcoin, or oil and control that whole asset.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. Then by being able to control a much bigger asset, a $200,000 asset with $20,000, but I get the $20,000 of appreciation, the $200,000 of appreciation or $200,000 of tax write-off, even though I'm only controlling it with $20,000 of my own money.
Exactly. So your return on investment in that example is 100%.
Yeah.
You've doubled your money with very little money. So yeah, you know, I liken it to this. Remember when you were a kid and you discovered that your shadow was really big, right? Like the sun was at your back and you looked forward and you saw your shadow along the sidewalk was 9 feet, right?
Yeah.
And you thought, hey, that's kind of cool. Well, that's really what income property allows you to do through leverage, is you can control, as you said, a much larger asset with much less. So your risk is lower and your ability to generate wealth from that is magnified dramatically.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just spent some time out in Arizona hanging out with Robert Kiyosaki, and he kept pounding into my head, controlling the asset, but also not putting your own money into the asset, even
right.
Controlling an asset you don't even have your own money into. So real estate offers all types of opportunities. We won't get into that. We don't have time, but offers all types of opportunities that can't be overstated. But man, Jason, that was some amazing stuff. I really appreciate that index. Like I said, it's I say stuff like that off the top of my head, but I don't have the actual data, the actual numbers.
Right. Yeah.
Now
you
I
intuitively know this, right?
Yeah. 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 Intuitively. So I'm going to do that. So we're going to, is that available on your website? Should we link to that?
You know, it's not. And the reason I haven't done it yet is we're producing a white paper right now, and we're going to have a whole book on the index.
Okay.
So we're going to have a ton of material. Just get on my mailing list, through jasonhartman.com. Or if you want that free mini book, go to pandemicinvesting.com and we'll get that out there. But, we're still, tweaking some things, so we didn't want to publish anything quite yet.
Got it. So we'll link to that. And then where else should people follow you?
Just jasonhartman.com, or the book at pandemicinvesting.com is good.
You got it. All right, we're gonna make sure we link to both of those. And
I'm sorry, Mark, YouTube or podcast, of course. Yeah,
which they'll find on your website.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, with that, we're gonna go ahead and sign it off. Jason, thanks so much for sharing that today.
Good stuff. Happy investing to you and everybody listening. Thanks, Mark.
Right. Bye.